And we thank you both. We thank you all. Case number two, Alexander versus Mount Sinai Hospital et al.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Harry Lee. I represent the appellant Irma Alexander, the special administrator of her mother's estate. Her mother's name is Kristen Kretcher. Sitting at the counsel's table with me is Paul Hardiman, who's the trial attorney in this case, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, we're asking this court to reverse and remand this matter and to either direct the trial court, the district court, to dismiss this case for want of jurisdiction, or to order a new trial in this case. The key question on the jurisdictional issue is whether Dr. Onima was a contractor of a publicly funded health care center. If he was, then the determination by the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services that he was a deemed employee of the federal government is unreviewable, and the United States government was properly substituted for Dr. Onima, thus giving federal court jurisdiction over this matter. As each of the defendants point out, the remaining state court defendants are in federal court by way of supplemental jurisdiction. However, if Dr. Onima was not a contractor of a publicly funded health care center, then the federally supported Health Centers Assistance Act does not apply, and there was no basis for jurisdiction in this case. I don't think there's any dispute in this case that Dr. Onima was not the contractor of the publicly funded health care center in this case. The contractor was Dr. Onima's medical corporation. And the medical corporation is clearly a separate legal entity under Illinois law. There was never any finding that there was any fraud involved. There was never any piercing of the corporate veil in this case. And according to the Secretary of State's records, this corporation had been a corporation in good standing from 1978 through 2003. The language of the Federally Supported Health Centers Assistance Act specifically states that the Secretary is authorized to deem a contractor of a publicly funded health center as a federal employee.
It seems that the issue is timing here, isn't it? Why is this any different than, say, a sporting event where after the game is played you realize there was a bad call somewhere along the line, can't replay the whole game? And position here it seems to be that at the time the decision was made that it was a deemed employee, everyone is bound by that, and even though it turned out later after the dust had settled, that was an erroneous characterization of the relationship. It's too late.
I don't agree that it's timing. We're addressing jurisdiction, which of course can be raised at any time. And the question in this case is whether the act, which is the sole basis for jurisdiction in this case, even applies. The issue of whether Dr. Onima was the contractor in this case was brought before the district court long before the trial of this matter. It was brought before the district court in 2002. This case, I believe, was tried in 2005. So it's not that we're coming in after the ruling in this case and now raising for the first time this issue of whether Dr. Onima was the contractor.
I'm not criticizing you're raising this issue, but I'm just concerned about when is there a finality of a decision like this? When
Well, I think, I mean, assuming...
I mean, the only thing you really have to hang your hat on is the reversal of this decision. Am I correct?
No, that's not correct.
Are you saying it was wrong in the first instance?
We're saying it was wrong in the first instance.
But once that decision was made in the first instance, then it's a non-reviewable decision, isn't it?
Assuming that there was assuming that the act even applied, the secretary only had authority to deem a contractor as a federal employee if the act applied. If the act did not apply, there was no jurisdiction.
It's never a non-reviewable decision, then.
No, the determination, if in fact Dr. Onimo was a contractor and the secretary did, as the secretary did in this case, made a determination that this contractor should be considered a deemed employee, then it's unreviewable. But the point I'm making is, if he's not a contractor in the initial instance, the act doesn't apply at all, and we don't even go on to the question of what the statute says in terms of reviewability or non-reviewability. We're dealing with the preliminary question, and that is, does the act apply at all? If the act doesn't apply at all, there's no basis for jurisdiction in this case. If there's no basis for jurisdiction in this case should be dismissed for want of jurisdiction and returned to the state court where it should be tried.
The way that you phrased the question, though, counsel, is an end run around the finality language in the statute. You're trying to parse it out and say, well, you know, to determine whether the statute applies, we have to decide the issue that the agency already decided, which is final and conclusive and binding.
Well, no, what I'm saying, I guess what I'm saying, and perhaps I'm not saying it clearly, is that before the secretary has any authority to make this deeming determination, the secretary must be dealing with a party that is in fact a contractor of a publicly funded healthcare center.
But that asks us to undo the deeming decision, and the statute says we can't do that.
But this court can make a determination as to jurisdiction. This court can always make a determination as to jurisdiction. And if there was no jurisdiction in the initial instance, the court does not have to make that determination. This court does not have to determine or decide that that determination by the secretary was wrong.
It's never a non-reviewable decision.
No, it is a non-reviewable decision if, in fact, the physician is a contractor. If the physician is not a contractor, the act doesn't apply.
But that question is subsumed in the deeming decision made by the secretary.
Yeah. It's not the way I believe that the statute reads. I think the statute reads that the determination applies, may be made as to contractors. I don't think there's anything in the statute that gives to the secretary the right, the power, the authority to determine who is a contractor. Now, there's language in the statute which talks about minimum requirements that each contractor must meet, the minimum requirements being working a certain number of hours or being certified or licensed. But that's something separate from the preliminary question, and that is this a contractor? If it's not a contractor, the act does not apply. Then we do not need to even consider the determination that this contractor, is properly deemed a federal employee.
Let me take you into a little different area for a moment or two.
Sure, Your Honor.
One of your experts had a current medical practice that consisted, it would seem, largely of performing abortions. What I wondered was why wasn't a motion in limine made before trial to avoid any inflammatory language? In other words, it could have been dealt with before trial or in voir dire in a much more effective way than waiting for the defendants to bring it up and then crying foul.
There was no motion in limine. It wasn't anticipated as a problem in this case. That's the simple answer to the question, Your Honor. It wasn't anticipated. However, when that comment was made by counsel, clearly the only purpose for such a comment in a case of this nature is to inflame the jury, to incite the jury. And we're arguing that despite the fact that it wasn't presented initially as a matter in the motion in limine, it in effect denied, it was at least one of the bases for a denial of a fair trial to my client in this case.
And speaking of comments, there was no objection to the district court's hindsight comments, so why isn't that waived?
Again, it's a comment that has to be considered in the total context of the case. There was no specific, there was no objection made to that comment when it was made, but it has to be considered together with the various other comments and remarks that were made by the trial judge that indicated a preference or that certainly could have demonstrated some sort of influence that could have been directed towards the jury in this case. And also the argument on that point is it was such an offensive comment to make in a case where one of the key defense theories in the case was this notion that hindsight is 20/20. To have the trial judge make such a comment at the end of the case after both sides had rested, that hindsight is perfect on this also, it in effect reinforced the defense theory. It wasn't objected to, but again, it putting it in the context of other remarks in this case that were objected to, we feel that it's a basis for a conclusion that there was a denial of a fair trial to our client, my client in this case, Your Honor. As long as we're on the subject of the improper remarks, the other improper remark by counsel was the repeated argument that Americans sue too often. Like the abortion remark, this remark was totally irrelevant to anything in this lawsuit, and its only purpose could have been to incite and to inflame the jury. Now, these remarks by counsel were objected to. In the initial instance, the trial court sustained the objection, although stating that perhaps or that may have been a stretch to make such a comment. I think it was certainly more than a stretch. I think it was an argument without legs. I believe there was no evidence whatsoever to support.
Is there a motion for a mistrial?
Not with respect to that argument.
So then, aren't you kind of stuck with that record?
Well, counsel did object.
If it was so, I mean, that's what we usually look for when a comment is just so inflammatory that it's going to make it impossible for you to get a fair trial.
Well, the thing is, Your Honor, plaintiff's counsel is objecting continuously to improper remarks throughout the trial. Counsel's objecting to the abortion comment. Counsel's objecting to the closing argument comments. Counsel's objecting to the remarks regarding what Dr. Moran said with respect to irrigating the abdomen in this case. I mean, all of these objections were made, so the question is, how many objections do you need to make, or do you need to make simply a request for a mistrial? I think the cumulative effect of the errors in this case are such that a new trial should be granted, notwithstanding no request for a mistrial at the tail end of the trial.
Those errors, though, would only go to the jury portion of the case, not to the Federal Tort Claims Act.
Well,
action.
That's
the judges presumed to be able to be, I guess, above the sort of appeal to raw emotion.
Unless the trial judge, as was the case with Dr. Moran's supposed testimony concerning irrigation of the wound, believes that that in fact was her testimony and indicates that at least that's one of the bases for the court's decision in favor of the United States.
As to the defendant, United States, what was the effect of the admission of Winkle's testimony that he was unsure when the perforations occurred? Because the issue of when the perforations occurred seemed immaterial to the district court's decision to enter judgment for the United States. No,
I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that if you look at the, and I'm sure the court has, but the district court's decision was essentially based on the belief that the signs and symptoms that Mrs. Crutcher was exhibiting in the days after her abdominal surgery did not point to the area of the abdomen as the problem, as the reason for these signs and symptoms. Rather, what was going on was a problem in the lungs. So if Dr. Winkle testifies that nothing wrong happened at the time of the abdominal surgery, and he actually testified in two different manners that nothing wrong. First, he said, I don't even know that a perforation occurred at the time of the surgery. It may have occurred at the time of the resection, which was on October the 16th. Secondly, he testified on cross-examination that it may have been because there was a partial tear on October 2nd, the date of the surgery, and this partial tear may not have eroded to the point where there were signs and symptoms until later. So I think that that's the connection between Dr. Winkle's improper opinion testimony and the district court's decision with respect to the United States in this case. There seemed to be some question in the mind of the trial court as to whether these were even opinions. The trial court distinguished these statements by Dr. Winkle as non-affirmative opinions. I don't think there's anything in Rule 26 that distinguishes between non-affirmative and affirmative opinions. All opinions and the basis for opinions must be disclosed. The reason these were opinions is simply because they were statements made in response to a question that sought an opinion. The question that was posed to Dr. Winkle was, now, does the fact that there are two perforations as opposed to one perforation mean anything to you about whether Dr. Onema violated the standard of care in the procedure? That's a question that's seeking opinions from an expert. And the expert answered in the manner he did, providing the testimony regarding the possibility that the perforation occurred at the time of the resection, not at the time of the original surgery, which, by the way, was surgery which had a recognized risk of bowel injuries, and in this case, an increased risk of bowel injuries because of the dense adhesions that were found. That is the reason why these were opinions, and this is the reason why they should not have been permitted without having previously been disclosed in this case. I wanted to spend just one more moment, if I may, and I'll eat into my rebuttal time. That's fine. I wanted to talk about the directed verdict that was entered in favor of Mount Sinai in this case. The district court, in effect, substituted its judgment for that of the only expert who actually testified on the subject of the resident's failure to order a surgical consult on October the 5th. Dr. Berman, a plaintiff's expert, a person who had trained residents his whole career, testified that if the attending physician had enough confidence in these residents to allow them to treat and care Mrs. Crutcher while he was out of the hospital, then they had an independent duty to order a surgical consult on October the 5th. And the failure to do so was a deviation from the standard of care. There was no contrary testimony. Notwithstanding that evidence, the district court granted a directed verdict in this case, stating that no reasonable jury could conclude that the residents deviated any duty by not ordering a surgical consult. In a case where the trial judge is sitting only as the finder of fact against the United States and not Mount Sinai Hospital, that was an improperly entered directed verdict in favor of Mount Sinai. Now, Mount Sinai, I think, recognized that in their response brief, and they suggested another reason why a directed verdict might have been appropriate in this case. They suggested that it was appropriate because there was no evidence of causation. And although they raised 3 points, I think the key question on this is that they said that there was no evidence that there would have been any surgical intervention or treatment that may have contributed to the recovery of this woman had a surgical consult been made. And our answer to that simply is that 10 days later, when a surgical consult was finally requested by Dr. Onema in this case, a surgeon came in, he scheduled and performed surgery on Mrs. Crutcher belatedly, but he performed it on the following day. And that's enough to let this question, the causation question, to go to the jury. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I'll pick
Thank
up
you.
And rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Okay. Ms. Jennings.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Diane Jennings, and I represent Mount Sinai Hospital Medical Center. So I've come up here at an opportune time in response to the last remarks. The only issues that I am interested or need to discuss with the court are, of course, the jurisdictional issue, because that affects all of us, and the directed verdict.
What is your best argument other than the factors relied upon by the district court for upholding the directed verdict? I mean, looking at it at this point, the district court did seem in part to be taking sides on some disputed facts and some disputed opinions.
Well, our best argument, Your Honor, first of all, is to look at the state of the evidence. There were three residents involved in this care, Dr. Smith, Dr. Jennifer Moran, and Dr. Siddiqui. As it is clear from the record, they never got out any criticism of Dr. Smith. The question that was seeking to elicit that was objection sustained because it was too broad. It was seeking to bring in the fourth as well as the fifth. So that question was never asked. So Dr. Smith, you could not predicate it on this record on Dr. Smith. You couldn't predicate it on Dr. Siddiqui, who was criticized for the October 6th because she wasn't there on October 6th. She provided no care on October 6th, and plaintiff's expert acknowledged if she wasn't there on the 6th, then of course he had no criticism.
Are you talking about Moran or about?
This is Dr. Siddiqui. So really the only resident whose care could be possibly an issue on the state of this record is Dr. Jennifer Moran the morning of October 5th. Now, it is undisputed on the record that Dr. Onyema that morning and Dr. Rossman that morning, in their own minds, had decided that this lady did not have a surgical problem, and that was based on the evidence in front of them. She had bowel sounds. Her abdomen was soft. There was bowel movement. She was feeling better. Her temperature was down. It was in their mind that there was no surgical problem and therefore no need for a surgical consultation. Also, it was their opinion that as of that time, she was not a candidate for surgery because of her severe lung problems. So now we come down to Dr. Siddiqui, who's just starting the third year of her four-year residency. And that morning, she comes in. She is told by Dr. Smith the condition of the patient that he has suggested an infectious disease consult. She does what she is supposed to do. She calls Dr. Onyema to get his approval of the plan. Dr. Onyema says to her, forget the ID consult, get this lady into intensive care. She can't breathe. There is no evidence from a surgeon that if he had been called, number one, that he would have even come in if Dr. Onyema didn't want him, and Dr. Onyema did not want a surgical consult. There is no evidence that if he came in and said, gee, maybe you ought to think about surgery, that Dr. Onyema or Dr. Rossman would have done so. And in fact, 2 days later, on October 7th, when another doctor, when the cardiologist said, gee, think about surgery, they didn't think about surgery at that time. There is no evidence that a surgeon would have come in and said, well, you know, I know you're afraid she's going to die if I give her anesthesia, but what the heck, let's give it a shot. There's no evidence that a surgeon on October 5th would not have agreed that her lung condition that morning was severe enough that she was not a good surgical risk, and a better option, which is the one that the treating physicians followed, was to try and drain this surgically rather than take her immediately into surgery. And in fact, even on the 15th of October, when the surgeon was consulted, he didn't think it was an emergency. He scheduled the surgery for the following day. And by that time, they knew there was an abscess. It was a proven thing. Her condition was such by the 7th that they knew. Your Honors, I see my time is up, and I don't want to eat into my colleague's time. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. Jack Donatelli for the United States. I have 5 minutes, but I'm in the happy position of a win-win. If we're right on jurisdiction, we have a trial victory. If plaintiff's right, there's no jurisdiction, I get dismissed out. I don't get that position on appeal very often, so I'm happy with it. I will only say this about jurisdiction further. Once HHS does the deeming, whether it's right or wrong, once they deem and then once the Attorney General certifies the scope of employment, there's your jurisdiction. That's when it kicks in and it exists.
So we should give no effect whatsoever to the supplemental authority filed? It seems the district court's now considering the government stopped from claiming that Oniyama is not a deemed employee.
That the district court concluded that? He actually... We suggested it's unreviewable. He said, I don't know that it is, but then went on and said, I really think he is a government employee. That wasn't our
No, I'm talking about the government's position in the new case.
Oh.
Yeah.
Which one? Well, I got several.
You're right. There are several. What's the government's position on appeal going to be in those cases? Ha, ha, ha.
I can tell you I'm still in the process of developing that, Judge.
Oh, sure.
But here's what's going on. This is our position. Dr. Odim was deemed in this case. Then when a second case came along in front of Judge Moran, we looked again and we said, you know what, we think we read it too broadly. We made a mistake. Judge Moran accepted that argument. Then it gets re-raised in this case. Judge Koukouras deals with it. And now I got it in front of Judge Dara and in front of Judge Gotchel. So I think it's going to go away because I think we have a new contract with Dr. Onyema. That's not with his medical entity, which is what we wanted all along. So that's as much as I know. And then as to, because I only got 5 minutes, as to the disclosure issue, I do want to say, you know, the kind of arguments you heard today, this is exactly what we're hearing now in these Rule 26 disclosure cases. It seems as though if the expert doesn't get on the stand and read his report word for word, if he says anything beyond that, we're getting this non-disclosure kind of argument. It's like the Rule 26 report becomes the whole game instead of the trial being the game, when in actuality, the Rule 26 report's a discovery tool. And as this court recognized in the Keech case, there's also other tools that a party has, which is cross-examination at trial, and I think this is the avenue that plaintiff should have taken rather than claiming this is an undisclosed opinion. The government's expert's opinion was clear. I don't know when the perforations occurred, sometimes from the first surgery until her death. And the objected to opinions now are that, yeah, it's possible it occurred at that first surgery. Well, yeah, that's what he said. And he said it's also possible it could have occurred at the resection. And that's within that same time period. But what happens if it's not in the exact words, you start getting these arguments. And I think it's really a misuse of the whole Rule 26 disclosure. So for these reasons, we ask this court to affirm the judgment in favor of the United States. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Schroeder.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Brian Schroeder. I'm appearing on behalf of Dr. Joseph Rossman. One of the big issues that have been raised by plaintiff and by yourself has been the comment about Dr. Berman's performing abortions in his current practice. First off, I want to say, although it hasn't been touched upon too much by Mr. Lee, that exposing, as Judge Kokoris said below, the qualifications and what an expert witness currently does is extremely relevant to the jury so that the jury can decide the expert's credibility and how much credence to lend to his testimony that is critical of Dr. Rossman in this case. Moreover, if you want to assume for the moment, which we, as I just said, deny that it was erroneous for that comment to be made, Dr. Berman was questioned without objection at trial on page 760 of the record, and the following question was asked: and your current practice involves patients with birth control pills, IUDs, and terminations? And the answer was yes. There was no objection made to that comment. So what we have here is evidence coming in without objection, no argument by plaintiff that that was improper, and but yet plaintiff is now claiming that the use of the term abortion in opening statement in and of itself is erroneous. I think if you want to accept his argument, is premised on the jury heard the word abortion and said, well, we're done hearing the rest of this case, we don't care anymore. Any juror that would be so offended by the use of that word would, of course, know that the word terminations is the same thing. And as Judge Kokoris himself said when he denied the motion for mistrial, when he ruled on the motion in limine right before Dr. Berman testified, he said, you can use terminations, not abortions. And then he said, whether the jury knows that those are synonymous is another matter. I think that they certainly would know that. And then going further, if you still believe that there was some sort of improper influence on the jury on this, we have Dr. Onyema, Dr. Siddiqui, Dr. Jennifer Moran, Dr. Smith, and Dr. Rossman, five doctors who examined the decedent on October 3rd, October 4th, and October 5th. Multiple occasions, they all said she had an obvious respiratory problem. She clearly had pneumonia, and they all also said we had no indications of any abdominal problems. You have several chest x-rays that confirmed a diagnosis of pneumonia, and you also had an abdominal x-ray that showed no free air in the abdomen. And Dr. Klotz, one of plaintiff's own experts, said that the absence of free air in the abdomen is, quote, a hallmark, unquote, for diagnosing a perforated bowel. In other words, you have overwhelming evidence that Dr. Rossman had no reason to believe that there was any bowel perforation in this case, and therefore any error, if you find there was error in the use of the term abortion, had no impact on the outcome of the trial because there was overwhelming evidence that Dr. Rossman complied with the standard of care in any event.
I take it there was no voir dire of the prospective jurors about their ability to fairly evaluate the testimony of an expert who performed abortions?
No, there was not. None in the record. No, Your Honor. Judge Evans had asked why there was no motion for a mistrial made regarding the statement in closing argument about how being a citizen now gives someone the right to go out and sue somebody. There was a motion for mistrial, as we know, about the comment and opening argument. The fact that there was no such motion for mistrial made regarding the closing statement, I think, indicates a recognition by plaintiff that, as Judge Evans noted, this comment in closing was really not as big a deal as is now being tried to be played up as an appeal before this court. And again, I would emphasize that there was no prejudice from any of these claimed errors, be it the cross-examination of Dr. Klotz regarding Dr. Jennifer Moran's testimony about irrigation of the bowel, the closing argument, as I just alluded to before, the argument about the use of the word abortion in opening statement, because, again, we had five doctors over three different days saying, I examined the decedent. I had every indication she had a pulmonary problem. I had no indication that there was a bowel problem. Chest x-rays, abdominal x-rays showing the absence of free air. I think, again, any air you may find, we, of course, are arguing there was none, was not outcome determinative and therefore should be deemed harmless. On the issue of jurisdiction, I don't have much else to say that anyone else hasn't already said. Judge Gottschall's decision was both that, as Judge Rovner noted, was that the United States was stopped from arguing that Dr. Onyema was not a federal employee, and she also went on to rule alternatively, just as Judge Kokoris did in this case, that form should not be exalted over substance, and the contract in this case, which recognized that Dr. Onyema was the sole employee of his corporation, the contract went on to further state that St. Francis Health Center desires to retain the physician, explicitly referring to Dr. Onyema, and the physician accepts such retention, I think shows that the substance of that contract was that the hospital wanted Dr. Onyema, and the fact that his medical corporation signed off as a signatory to the contract on paper, Dr. Onyema signed it in person, of course, is a distinction without a difference. believe that's all I have. If there are any other questions, I'll be happy to take them. Otherwise, Dr. Rossman asks that you affirm the jury verdict for all defendants. Thank you.
Mr. Wood.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michael Weber. I represent the defendant Sinai Medical Group in this case. Sinai Medical Group was the employer of Dr. Rossman. My immediate preceding counsel addressed many of those issues. It is clear in this case that any decision of this court rises and falls on Dr. Rossman. There was no individual allegations as to any negligence on the part of Sinai Medical Group, so the issues as to those parties are aligned. I believe that in this case that this court should deny all of the relief that has been requested by plaintiff in this matter. I also believe that any ruling in favor of plaintiff as to the directed verdict as to Mount Sinai Hospital should not have any impact upon the jury verdict, which was entered in favor of Dr. Rossman and Sinai Medical Group in this case. Clearly, the issues of the negligence or lack of negligence on behalf of Dr. Rossman and Sinai Medical Group are separate and distinct from any issues which were raised in the appeal as it relates to Sinai Hospital itself or as to the government. And I believe that as a result, any determination in favor of plaintiff would not mandate reversal of the actual jury verdict in favor of Dr. Rossman, and that should stand. Clearly, the federal court had supplemental jurisdiction, has been noted, over the remaining defendants. There was a complete and considered trial on the issues before a jury as to Dr. Rossman and Sinai Medical Group, and I think, as Judge Evans pointed out, it would be sort of going back to square one. It would be manifestly unfair to the defendants. It would certainly be a waste of judicial resources to retry this matter against these defendants if other determinations were made as to Sinai Medical, Sinai Hospital, or as to the government. Clearly, there was no abuse of discretion on the part of the court in terms of any of the evidentiary rulings which were made in this matter.
Let me just follow up on that last point. If the decision here was that there was no federal jurisdiction, and the case then had to go back to state court, what, if any, collateral estoppel, res judicata, or some other type of doctrines would be available for you to argue that the case was fully and fairly tried before one jury in the federal courthouse in Chicago and another jury should not have to be impaneled in a state court to hear the same thing?
Well, I think that all of those arguments would be available, and that's why I make the point that in terms of judicial economy, it would be a misuse of the sources of the resources of the court and certainly unfair to the defendants to go through exactly the same routine, all of the discovery, all of the trial, presumably and hopefully to attain the same results simply before a different forum. I think that the exercise of the federal jurisdiction over these defendants was sufficient, and I think there would be a substantial defense to any retrial in another jurisdiction.
Don't you need a good judgment to get collateral estoppel or res judicata effect? And if there's no jurisdiction, it's not a good judgment.
An affirmance in this court. Is that what Your Honor is referring to?
Well, if this case went back to state court because there was no jurisdiction in this court or in federal court at all, what is there for the state court to give res judicata effect to?
I have not fully researched that issue, Your Honor, and I think it is difficult.
Well, that's why I couch my question in the terms of collateral estoppel or some other theory that's floating around out here somewhere that would prevent or be available to you to argue to prevent a retrial if the case went back to state court?
It's an issue I hope I don't have to address.
That would be for a state court judge to decide, I suppose.
That is correct. Okay. I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Maybe Mr. Lee can tell us about that.
How much time? 1 minute.
Well, you don't have to spend your minute on that.
Well, that's fine.
I'll give you an extra minute for that.
I was going to ask the same question Judge Sykes asked about that. And I think if there's no jurisdiction, I think the whatever took place is void. I don't think there's any binding effect on the state court. Judge Evans, you asked a question about the timing of raising this issue regarding jurisdiction, and I believe the record reflects this. A notice of appeal was filed after the district court made its determination regarding jurisdiction, and that notice of appeal, I believe, was rejected by this court as the appeal not being timely, or not being timely, rather, it not being ready.
What was the district court asked to certify an interlocutory appeal?
The only other point I wanted to mention, actually 2 points, in terms of what was going on with Kristen Crutcher from October 2nd to October 5th, it wasn't a clean picture. I mean, this lady had an increased temperature that she was running each and every one of those days. She had a distended bowel. She had faint bowel sounds, and she had accelerated white blood cell count. Also, she was on the most powerful antibiotics at that point. So there were things going on that could have been attributable to the abdomen. Plus, as I mentioned in my opening argument, this was surgery that had a risk of injury to the bowel, and an increased risk because of the dense adhesions. The only other point I wanted to mention is with regards to Rule 26, I don't get in federal court a lot, but I assume Rule 26 is just like Rule 213. It's to prevent surprise, the type of surprise that occurred in this case when Dr. Winkle was permitted to present his new opinions at trial. If the court has no further questions, I ask that the court reverse and remand for the reasons stated initially. Thank you.
You may not get into federal court often, but we really appreciate your advocacy, as well as all of you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement.